Hey y'all, we're here on this very cold, blustery day here. We're recording on my iPad here. I just figured I'd go to the bathroom first before I explain what we're going to do. Now, this might take about 2 or 3 hours, so this might be the longest recording I ever did on Dropbox, and I might fill up my Dropbox right up to hell, but, fuck you, deal with it. I can always just, if my VM, like if Adriano, if you ever get up my VM again, for being on good terms again, that'll be good. So, what we're gonna do here is go to the bathroom here. Excuse me for the... I had to go poop. So. I might actually go sit outside and hear a recording of my tape player while it's being run. Now this is not an ordinary freaking tape player. By far, it's not. And shit. This is not an ordinary tape player. By far. Now, what we're gonna do here. Ew, and a touch poop shit. Pull up my pants. Just let it go for now.
10:45 a.m. One notification. Calendar. In 30 meters. PT. Today at 11:15 a.m.
Shut the fuck up, you fucking asshole. I got a recording to do. Alright. Alright. We're dressed for the weather. Now we're just gonna leave this recording. And we're gonna go out here outside and I'll show you how cold it is. I'm gonna show you how freaking cold it is outside right now. Alright. Now, allow me to show you. So we're gonna make, maybe I'll, let me see what time it is, hold on.
10:46 a.m. One notification.
10:46?
Calendar. In 29 meters.
Let's
PT.
Stay out till like, I guess we go out the kitchen way. Yeah, I'll go out that way. Sure, why not? And then, we can go over here without wasting time to grab my cane. We can go outside here. I'm holding the iPad, so if it fucking breaks, I'm gonna be fucking mad.
I will.
Oh. Don't you guys? I will be fucking mad. I'm gonna go over here. I want to go outside. Maybe not. Way too cold out there. Way too cold. I don't have a hat and gloves on. So, we're gonna wait for a while. In the meantime, you can go on the couch and I'll record my story. Actually, so you can hear my story. Who knows, I might make it about, I might let you hear the rest of the stories. My iPad makes it. Well, it'll be interesting to see how much it uploads. I'll record my lunch too. I'm gonna record all day. My day is just getting started.
Player on. Volume up.
Moments later, the speedboat swung past the buoy, coming to a stop. A dinghy was tied behind it. Sweeper stepped to the speedboat's deck, and Frank could see that he was looking around. Watching the man, Frank swam quietly toward the dinghy. As Sweeper's attention turned to an approaching launch, Frank drew himself stealthily into the dinghy. He stretched out on the bottom of the boat. His hand touched a tarpaulin, and he pulled the canvas over him. Wood scraped wood as the launch came alongside the speedboat. Frank lifted a corner of the tarpaulin and peered at the strange craft. Two men emerged from its cabin and stepped into the speedboat. One was a stranger. The other, Clang. They sat with Sweeper in the cockpit of the speedboat, and the three began to talk earnestly. Frank strained to hear what they were saying. The sound of the waves washing against the boats and the tinkle of the bell on the buoy drowned out their words. Frank inched toward the bow of the dinghy and felt cautiously for the painter that held it to the speedboat. Pulling on it, he brought the small craft near the one which held the three conspirators. The boy could hear their voices distinctly now. He slid under the tarpaulin once more. The stranger was speaking.
Alibis, that's all I hear. The syndicate wants action.
We need more time, said Clem.
Time for what? First man said. For those engineers to fill the valley with water and ruin our plans? For Carpenter's detectives to make trouble?
Frank grinned as Sweeper retorted.
They're just kids. I'll take care of them. See that you do, the first man told him gruffly. Clang, I'll give you 4 more days. If Foster hasn't completed his tests by that time...
He broke off as a rattle of tin came from the dinghy.
What's that? He demanded.
Frank suppressed an exclamation of annoyance. His foot had knocked over an oil can, and it rattled from one side of the boat to the other with every roll of the waves.
Sounds like a tin can, Clang remarked.
I'll get rid of it, Sweeper said. That racket makes me nervous.
Frantically, Frank felt with his foot, found the can, and pressed it against the side of the dinghy. The rattle stopped.
Never mind, sweeper,
the stranger said. Frank breathed in relief until he heard the thin man say softly,
I'm not sure it was just a can. I didn't pull this dinghy right up to the boat, and it didn't drift up. And I didn't spread canvas all over the bottom of it.
He walked toward the dinghy, bent over its bow, and yanked off the tarpaulin.
Okay, kid, he snarled. Get up. The hide-and-seek game's over.
As Frank stood up, he cast a quick glance toward Merriam Island. His heart sank. The boats had drifted out from the buoy too far for him to swim to safety. Sweeper turned to the stranger and declared,
This is one of the snoopers who's helping Carpenter and Ames.
The stranger stared at the youth. Clang spoke up harshly.
I know this kid. Too smart for his own good. I'll take care of him this time.
The stranger's hand shot out and pulled Clang back.
No rough stuff, he ordered.
Let's cut the kid adrift,
Sweeper suggested.
The tide's going out. By the time anybody picks him up, we'll be through with our job.
The stranger nodded.
Good idea. Cut the line, Sweeper.
The thin man removed a pair of oars from the dinghy, then stepped back into the speedboat and unhooked the painter. The dinghy drifted away rapidly.
So long, kid,
Sweeper called mockingly.
Don't get your feet wet.
Frank sat down in the boat and watched helplessly as the tide carried it out to sea. He scanned the water. No ship was in sight.
You've done it now, he told himself bitterly. No oars, no food, no water to drink. And if I know anything about clouds, a storm's blowing up.
Frank studied the water and the black sky. Then, as his eyes fell on the empty oarlocks, a plan formed in his mind. He straightened the tarpaulin. Then he twisted and squeezed a corner of the canvas to make a short length of rope, which he thrust through one of the locks. He tied the end into a tight knot, tugging it hard against the oarlock to make sure it could not slip through. He did the same with the adjacent corner of the canvas, knotting it outside the second oarlock. Frank sat and waited as the boat bobbed in the darkness. It was not long before the sea began to churn harder. The wind was rising. Now Frank stood in front of a seat, holding aloft the untied corners of the tarpaulin. He stretched his arms wide. The impact of the wind rushing into the canvas almost knocked him overboard, but he braced the calves of his legs on the edge of the seat and stiffened himself against the wind and cold water. The improvised sail sent the boat plunging through the waves toward the island. Lightning snaked across the sky. Thunder boomed, and rain fell in torrents. The waves leaped higher, and Frank nearly lost his balance several times. Suddenly, a gust of wind caught him full force, tearing a corner of the canvas from his hands. He reached for the flapping tarpaulin, but lost his footing just as a huge wave sent the dinghy reeling. Frank pitched forward and plunged headlong into the sea. The boy struggled to the surface and shook the water from his eyes. The dinghy was drifting away rapidly, whipped by the wind. Chapter 12. Decoy Hunt. Desperately, Frank's eyes searched the darkness for the island. A wave lifted him, and he was suddenly conscious of the tinkling of a bell. The buoy! He turned his head and saw the light a few feet from him, bobbing and blinking. Thankfully, Frank swam toward it and clung to the chain. The island was only 100 yards away, but his strength was gone. He closed his eyes and waited for the storm to abate. It was daylight when the weather cleared. Frank attempted to strike out for the sandy shore, but his arms felt too heavy to move. Suddenly, he spotted a helicopter approaching the island. Frank shouted and waved weakly. He saw a man signal through the craft's window, and a minute later the helicopter hovered directly over him and started to descend. It halted 30 feet above the water and hung in the air. The cabin door was thrust open, and a blond-haired youth looked down.
Frank! He yelled. Hang on! We'll drop a line!
It was Joe. Frank grinned.
I'm all right, he yelled as loudly as he could. Just get me out of this soup.
Joe laughed with relief.
Okay, he called. Catch!
A nylon rescue line with a breeches buoy was dropped, and Frank was drawn up safely into the helicopter.
Boy, I was afraid for a minute I was seeing things,
Frank said weakly as his brother and father wrapped him in blankets. Frank did not feel strong enough to discuss his experience until he was home and had taken a hot shower. Then, fortified with a bowl of hearty soup, he described in detail what had happened. Mrs. Hardy and Aunt Gertrude looked worried.
It's a wonder you didn't drown, his aunt declared. I think a doctor should have a look at you.
Frank insisted he felt much better.
But you must be exhausted, his mother said.
I think you should get right into bed,
Mr. Hardy agreed. I am pretty tired, Frank confessed with a smile. As Joe accompanied his brother upstairs, he told him of his discovery that Sweeper was Timothy Kimball Jr.
I thought Sweeper was a phony-sounding name, Frank said, smothering a yawn.
Or a nickname,
Joe said. But Frank had already stretched out on his bed and was beginning to doze. Joe tiptoed from the room and found his father waiting for him in the study.
What Frank overheard last night means we'll have to act fast, Mr. Hardy said quietly. I'm afraid of what the gang will do to Dr. Foster. If only we knew where they're holding him.
My guess is that they have a hideout on Skull Mountain, Joe said. He may be there. If we could find Klang or Sweeper, we might be able to follow them to the place.
Right, said Fenton Hardy. Joe, you go to Klang's house. Try to find out if he's there. If not, when he'll be back. And son, be careful.
I understand, Joe told him.
The plumbing shop is closed, Mr. Hardy went on. But Klang and the others may be using it as a meeting place. Do you suppose Chet could stand watch on it? The crooks would be less apt to notice a boy than a man, I think.
Sure, Chet could do it, Joe said.
Good, the tall detective put on his hat. I'm going to Brookside and see if I can get Mr. Kimball to talk. He might know something that would help us.
Joe phoned Chet and told him of Frank's rescue. The stout boy was relieved. He quickly agreed to stake out the shop. Then he paused.
Oh! What's the matter? Joe said. I asked Biff Hooper to meet me at the boat landing this morning. I decided it would be easier for two people to look for those wooden things. One could man the boat if the water got rough.
Joe debated for a moment.
You'd better go ahead with that plan, he decided. The markers may come through the tunnel any time. I'll watch Klang's house, and later take over in the bay, while you keep an eye on the plumbing shop. Check, his friend agreed.
The window shades were still drawn in Klang's house when Joe drove up. He stepped onto the porch and rang the doorbell. To his surprise, the door opened at once, and a middle-aged woman wearing a faded dressing gown faced him.
What do you want?
Mrs. Klang?
Joe asked politely.
Yeah.
Is your husband at home?
Joe asked.
No.
The woman regarded Joe suspiciously.
What do you want him for?
Our kitchen faucet is leaking, Joe told her. We need someone to fix it.
The woman smirked.
It'll make a pool if you wait for Klang to take care of it. He's away on a trip.
Oh, that's right,
Joe said, as if he suddenly remembered where the man had gone.
Did he take a boat?
Boat?
The woman asked.
You don't go to the hills by...
She broke off abruptly and slammed the door in the boy's face. Joe grinned as he ran down the steps. The woman had been caught off guard. So Klang was in the hills. That must mean Skull Mountain. Joe drove to the boathouse. He guided the sleuth out of her slip and headed into the bay. A short distance from shore, he saw Chet sitting in the skiff with Biff Hooper, a high school companion.
Hi,
Joe called. The two waved to him, and Joe brought the sleuth alongside the skiff.
See anything yet?
Joe asked eagerly. Chet shook his head.
Maybe the stuff got stuck somewhere in the tunnel, he said. How'd you do at Klang's house?
Joe told him. Chet grinned and said,
Boy, you did good. I hope I find out something at the plumbing shop.
Want me to go out in the sleuth with you now?
Biff asked Joe.
I wish you would. Two pairs of eyes are better than one, and Chet had better head for his stakeout.
Fine, said Biff. I've fished for everything else in these waters. I may as well try my luck at catching a decoy duck.
Joe towed the skiff back to the boathouse and moored it there. Chet stepped ashore and saluted importantly.
Detective Morton on duty, he announced, and hurried away.
Chet found the plumbing shop closed, as Mr. Hardy had said. The stout boy peered through the plate glass window, but saw no one inside. Directly across the street was a hot dog stand. Chet brightened.
Chow time, he exulted. 12 o'clock.
He could station himself by the stand. Nobody would suspect he was watching. Chet strode over and ordered a hot dog and a tall glass of orange juice. 2 frankfurters and 3 glasses of juice later, Chet was still waiting for some sign of action at Klang's shop. For an hour, he strolled up and down the street, keeping an eye on the store. Finally, he stopped at the stand again and ordered a donut. As he took it from the man, he turned to face the store again. Suddenly, his eyes widened. A man was unlocking the door of the plumbing shop. Chet gulped nervously as the man limped into the store. Thrusting the donut into his pocket, the stout boy crossed the street. He looked through the window, but could not see anyone. The young detective wet his lips, and his Adam's apple bobbed as he swallowed. He tried the door and found it locked. Wiping his forehead, Chet paced back and forth for several minutes, staying a short distance from the shop. Suddenly, he started. 2 men were leaving Klang's place. Backing into a doorway, Chet watched them cross the street. 1 was the man with the limp. The other was tall and thin. As the pair neared the opposite curb, the taller man glanced around as if he suspected they were being followed. Chet swallowed and tried to look as if he were examining his wristwatch. The 2 men mounted a motorcycle and roared away. Chet's eyes popped at the peculiar, uneven rhythm of the motor. It was the machine Frank and Joe had described.
Well, I guess I cased them, Chet said to himself. Now to report to headquarters.
At the Hardy's house, Chet found Mr. Hardy and Frank seated in the detective's study. After greeting them, Chet earnestly told of his vigil. He wiped his brow as he concluded.
It was touch and go for a few minutes.
Mr. Hardy smiled, but declared heartily,
That's good work, Chet.
Are you going to tell the police?
The stout boy asked eagerly.
They could find the motorcycle and follow it to see where those fellows go.
That's too risky, replied Mr. Hardy. If the gang got wind of the police, they might silence Dr. Foster and clear out fast. There's a little time yet, he added. We must find them quietly on our own, then bring in help.
The detective went on to tell of his visit to Brookside.
I persuaded Mr. Kimball to level with me. Actually, he doesn't know as much as we do.
What about the man with the limp? Chet asked.
Mr. Hardy shrugged.
A Confederate. I feel sure now it would pay us to post a regular watch on the plumbing shop.
Chet asked.
You mean me?
Why not? The detective queried. You did a good job today.
The boy beamed.
Leave it to me, Mr. Hardy.
Frank stood up. Dad says Joe is watching Klang's house.
No, he was there,
said Chet, and told what Joe had found out about the plumber.
He's gone to Skull Mountain, all right, said Frank, and that's where we should go to search for that hideout. You can start tomorrow, his father agreed. Where's Joe now, Chet?
Out in the sleuth with Biff Hooper. They're looking for the stuff we planted in the reservoir.
I'll go down and help them, said Frank. Coming, Chet?
You bet!
It was late afternoon when the boys arrived at the boathouse. The sleuth had not returned.
We'll use our rowboat to look for Joe and Biff, Frank said.
They found the sleuth anchored in the bay. Joe and Biff were sitting in the cockpit. Frank rowed alongside.
Any luck? He asked.
No, his brother replied. I'm afraid the stuff came through during a storm and was washed out to sea.
If so, Frank said, frowning,
We'll have to forget it for now. First thing in the morning, we've got to go to Skull Mountain and search for Dr. Foster. The Hardys swapped places, Frank taking the wheel of the sleuth, Joe joining Chet in the rowboat. They hooked it by a tow line to the speedboat and started off. Frank guided the two crafts as close to the rocky shore as he dared. The boys examined the numerous coves which bit into the shoreline of the bay. Hours later, when it was dark, they still had seen no sign of the markers.
"Let's quit," Chet pleaded. "I'm starved."
"We'll try one more cove," Frank said. "If we don't spot the things, we'll go home." He steered the sleuth toward a rocky slit in the shore, then cut the motor. The two boats drifted into the cove. Frank trained the speedboat's searchlight on the steep shore. As he swept the light slowly along the waterline, the other youths searched with their flashlights. The lights made a complete sweep around the cove, but the boys saw nothing in the water. Discouraged, Frank swung his craft slowly back toward the mouth of the inlet. Suddenly, Joe thought he saw a small white object bump against the sleuth and veer away.
"Hold it!"
he yelled. Frank quickly cut the motor, and Joe leaned over the bow of the rowboat. He aimed the beam of his flashlight at the water. With a whoop of joy, he reached down and held up a dripping object.
"Here it is! Our duck!"
Chapter 13. Dangerous Cargo.
"That does it!"
Frank exclaimed as Joe showed the wet decoy to his excited companions.
"Now we're sure there's an underground channel from the reservoir to the bay."
"It must be a rough ride through the tunnel," Biff remarked. "Look at the scratches on that duck."
"Let's see," Frank said, and Joe passed him the decoy. He examined it carefully.
"No clues on this, but it gives me an idea. Let's look for the barrel stave and pine slab. Maybe there will be something on them to show where they entered the channel."
Using the sleuth's searchlight, the boys scanned the surface of the water, but found nothing more.
"I bet the rest of the things are stuck somewhere in the tunnel," Chet said.
Biff peered over the side of the speedboat.
"Must be a current down below," he observed. "Look how roily the water is here."
Frank nodded. "It's probably the fresh water flowing in from the reservoir and stirring up the sand and mud particles on the bottom of the cove." The Hardys decided to return at daylight to see if the stave or slab had come through. Frank pressed the sleuth's starter button, and the motor throbbed. Before he eased the two boats carefully out of the cove, Joe took a piece of white chalk from his pocket and inscribed a large X on a rock, well above the high tide mark. At dawn, the Hardys returned and easily found the chalk-marked cove again. As Frank guided the sleuth into the inlet, Joe grinned and pointed to a red-and-white object whirling in the water.
"How's that for luck?"
he exclaimed. Frank eased the craft over, and Joe seized the barrel stave. Quickly, they examined it. Stuck in the cracked wood was a twig of bramble bush.
"That's our clue,"
Frank exclaimed.
"There can't be bramble in the underground channel, so this twig must have caught on the stave as it was swept into the opening."
Joe chuckled.
"Now all we have to do is locate the right bramble bush, and we'll know where the entrance to the tunnel is."
Elated at their discovery, the boys headed the sleuth back to the boathouse. The fresh breeze cutting across the bay aroused their appetites.
"I could eat a stack of flapjacks," Joe said as they stepped ashore.
"So could I, with sausages."
As the boys were crossing the boat landing on their way to a nearby diner, Frank suddenly clutched Joe by the arm.
"Do you see what I see?"
he whispered, pulling his brother down with him behind an empty barrel. Walking along the dock was Sailor Hawkins. The old sea dog's back was toward the boys, but his short, squat figure and rolling gait were immediately familiar.
"What do you suppose he's doing in Bayport?"
asked Joe. Frank shook his head.
"One of us had better follow him," he said. "He may be on some business for Sweeper." "I'll do it," Joe told him. "You drive home and pick up the stuff we'll need for the camp. I'll phone you later and tell you where to meet me.
Joe followed Hawkins down the dock to a loading platform. He kept his eyes on the sailor, while sidestepping the shouting, sweating longshoremen who were trundling barrels and crates onto the wharf. The arm of a boom swung out from a freighter over the loading platform and hooked a rope net laden with heavy boxes. The cable drew taut, and the net was hauled swiftly into the air.
"Look out!"
a dock hand yelled frantically. Joe's head snapped up at the warning. One of the rope strands had broken, and the hook had torn loose from the net. The heavy cargo was hurtling down on him. He flung himself to one side, and the boxes crashed to the dock, not 6 feet away. There was a surge of excited voices as men looked down at him from the rail of the freighter, while others ran toward him along the wharf. A longshoreman helped the youth to his feet.
"Are you hurt?"
he asked. Joe shook his head and brushed the dirt from his clothes. He looked at the spot where he had last seen Hawkins, but the sailor had disappeared. With quick thanks, Joe shook off the dockhand and made his way toward the row of supply houses, cheap restaurants, and second-hand stores which lined the street opposite the wharf. He looked through the windows of the stores, but did not see Sailor Hawkins. Finally, at the end of the row, Joe came to a large warehouse. Cautiously, he stepped inside. The dim interior was stacked with crates, but there were no longshoremen in sight. Joe stopped short. Not far away, on a box, sat Hawkins.
Let me see what time it is.
11:13 a.m. One notification. Calendar. In 2 meters. PT. Today at 11:15 a.m.
All right, guys. Well, that's it. I will upload this. And, yeah.
Page 2 of... Press home to open. Stop. Button.